Session number 10039, Reel 1.
Lindsay Crozier, Reel 1. First of all, Lindsay, could I ask you about your background, you know, before the war started? I understand you were living in New Zealand.
Yes.
Were you born in New Zealand?
No. I was born in Galla Shields in Scotland. And when I was about 4.5 years old, our family migrated to New Zealand and settled down in the south of New Zealand. And there I received my primary and secondary education. And while I was a young person, I was always, of course, very interested in the outdoors and getting around. And then became very interested in photography. And so my friend and I moved up to a little place called Gore, G-O-R-E, and opened up a photographic studio. And because the war had then started, supplies were getting very short, and it wasn't easy to make a living, and so I decided to go into teachers' training college with the idea of specialising in visual education, which was just starting off then in New Zealand. And during my first year at training college, the course is normally 2 years or 3 years, but during my first year, the government, through the pressure of the RSA, that's the Returned Soldiers Association, forced the education department to give all conscientious objector teachers what they called leave of absence, which was really being virtually kicked out of training college.
Yes, before we go on to that, yes. Could I go back a little bit, you know, into your formative years?
Yes, good.
Your sort of education, because really what I'm trying to find out is what made you a pacifist? I wonder what these influences on your life were. You know, first of all, religion.
Yes.
Did you come from a religious family?
Well, I was brought up within the framework of the Baptist Church, and I was very, very fortunate. I was one of these people who had a most loving home. My parents were involved deeply in the Little Baptist Church in Invercargill. And as I began to think through the Christian ethic, I suppose the guiding line in all the things I've tried to do, at least I hope I've tried to do, would be, what would Christ do in this situation? And after a little bit of reading, I found that I couldn't for a moment comprehend Christ taking up arms, even in the defense of a good cause. And I suppose this was the criterion. I couldn't imagine Christ being involved in killing people. And so that was when I then decided to become a pacifist.
Have you any idea how old you would have been when these thoughts started, you know, developing in you? Would you have been a schoolboy, say, or was it later?
No, well, I was born in 1914, and I would imagine it was when I was about 30. I mean, 1930, I would be about getting on for then. About 1930, this is the attitude I took. And so I decided to meet with one or two friends who were taking the same attitude. I was also very fortunate that I had an older brother who was a Baptist minister, and he had come to the same conclusion from the Christian ethic. And so he was a great support to me. And the other thing which I appreciated tremendously was the support our parents gave to us. And I'm quite sure of this, that if I had decided to join the armed forces, they would equally have given me the same support, because they recognised that I had my life to live, and they respected the important decisions that we made. But that was a big help. And when the war came and people were being conscripted, as they were in New Zealand, then, of course, when the neighbours knew that I was a conscientious objector and had lodged an appeal on conscientious ground, then, of course, it's the parents who had the rough deal.
In what way, you know, how was this made manifest, this rough deal?
I think largely by the neighbours being snubbed, by my parents being snubbed because their son wasn't away in the war and their sons were. And I can appreciate this because feelings run fairly deeply. And I remember particularly a very good friend of mine from across the road. He'd no sooner joined the Navy than he was killed. And it must have been very hard for his parents to see me still living and their son not. And I can appreciate how they felt. The other thing is, I think people ought to know that in New Zealand is a tremendously loyal country to England and the Queen and the Empire. Tremendously loyal. And many people have said that the New Zealanders are more loyal than the British. You know what I mean? And I think you had this kind of ethos running right through through New Zealand. The strong patriotism there was for it. And being a small country, it had become renowned, I suppose, for its contribution at ANZAC. See, and the ANZACs are the Australian and New Zealand Army Corps, and they were the people, of course, who were at Gallipoli, and great heroes were made of the ANZACs. And so it was out of this group that the RSA sprung, and they were a very strong force in keeping up the emotional content of the war.
What was the RSA?
Returned Soldiers Association. And they're still a very powerful force. They're the people who run the poppies and things like this. See? And so they're the people who would like to bring in conscription again and things like this. See? So that, and they've had influential people amongst them. And I would say some very, very good people amongst them. Now, I'm not derogative to them because they were doing what they believed was right, and I hoped they respected those of us who took a different point of view.
It's very interesting, Lindsay, you know, you talking about Gallipoli. When you were growing up in New Zealand, you know, was this quite an influence? You know, did you know about World War One and the ghastliness of places like Gallipoli?
Yes, mostly through Gallipoli, because in every town and city and village, if you would call them, there would be somebody who had been on Gallipoli. And so that when you went around the homes, you'd see these pictures up with, sometimes with their medals and so on. See, so that Gallipoli was, I would think, the one thing. New Zealanders were involved slightly in the Boer War, but not to the extent that they were in the World War. And then, of course, that, I would say, would be the principal remembrance that I have of the impact of the First World War.
And did that, you know, you explained so well the basis of your pacifism, you know, that the religious and that Jesus Christ's example. Did the knowledge of what had happened in World War One, you know, the very nature of war, was that important as well, do you think?
I would think probably only from what you could read and see, because, see, in New Zealand we've had no first-hand experience of war like the people in Europe and you people have had. We were remote, miles away, particularly in the First World War. And so it was, you got, the only news you got was, of course, what was happening to New Zealanders in the conflict, whether it was in Gallipoli or in France or something like that. See, so that but we have no personal. And the other thing is that New Zealand being largely a primary producing country, you never suffered any kind of shortages in the First World War because of transport and so on. It was slightly different in the Second World War, but in the First it was different. And I would say basically that would be the background to my growing conviction of the insanity of war.
Did you have brothers and sisters? I've forgotten whether you mentioned.
Yes, I had my older brother, who was a Baptist minister, and he was 8 years older than I was. I had another brother who was 4 years older than I was, and he was spent most of his life in India. Then I have a younger sister who's about 4 years younger than I am. So
and was their attitude to the war the same as yours?
My oldest brother, definitely, because he spoke on behalf of the number of conscientious objectors in his capacity as a minister and also as a member of the peace group. My second brother, of course, was in India, so that we weren't involved with him. And my younger sister was also convinced because what is now her husband, he was also a conscientious objector, so that we had good family support.
Did you also, Lindsay, did you have any knowledge of COs in World War One? I mean, were there New Zealand conscientious objectors from World War One?
The outstanding one would be a man called Archibald Baxter, who had a very, very bad time in World War One. And in the little book I hope to be able to send you, it'll give full details of where he was and the treatment he had received.
Were there provisions made for COs, do you know, in World War One?
That I'm not certain, but I would think they would be, if they were, they'd be fairly tough. But I don't think that they were, but I may be wrong on that, see.
But had you heard about people like Archibald Baxter?
Oh, yes, yes.
When you decided that you must be a CO?
Yes, because in a small country like New Zealand, people who stand out in their particular cause get fairly well known. And I think everybody knew about the enormous suffering that he went through in the trenches.
The other thing, you mentioned regarding your brother, a peace organisation.
Yes.
Was there an anti-war movement in New Zealand, you know, in this sort of interwar period?
I would think that as, not so much in the intervening period, but immediately word of a possible conflict coming in the world, then it began to emerge again. Just like, see, at present in New Zealand, it's fairly much in abeyance because we're not involved in any conflicts. We'll get on to that later. But as immediately war broke out, young men began to think, now, which way am I going to jump, for or against? And it was then that in the Christian Pacifist Society, which was the principal peace group in New Zealand, emerged.
How big a society was that? You know, the number, the membership. Was it quite important?
Not that very big, but what its principal job was A, first of all, to encourage conscientious objectors, and B, they did a lot of street preaching against the war, and this is where a number of them fell foul of the law, particularly this man called Ormey Burton, I was telling you about, the Reverend Ormey Burton. And they said that it was illegal. They continued to preach. They were often taken off to jail, and some of them spent quite a long time in prison. And also they put out a limited amount of what we would call propaganda, anti-war propaganda, amongst friends and amongst some of the church people who were sympathetic. In New Zealand, I would say probably, apart from the Quakers, who've always had a very strong peace content, the Methodist Church in New Zealand would be the vocal anti-war people. To a lesser extent, the Presbyterians, and not much in the Anglican Church, because the Anglican Church is looked upon almost as the English Church, and therefore it's because of its whole ethos, you know. Good.
Or was there any link with the peace movement in England or any other country, do you know, in so far as New Zealand was concerned?
Yes, there was a definite link, and I would say it would be fair to say that to some extent the New Zealand group, being small, took its inspiration from the peace groups in England, because they were able then to be associated with them. And there are a number now throughout the world of peace groups. There's the Fellowship of Reconciliation. There's the, in New Zealand, it's the Christian Pacifist Society, which raises funds for these other inter-church. There's War Resisters International. And so we try to share in this overall work.
And that was happening in the 30s too, was
yes.
it?
Mm.
Yes. Mm. Did you know much of what was happening in Europe? You know, were you following events like, you know, first of all the Rhineland and then the Munich crisis, that sort of thing?
I would say basically the news that filtered through to New Zealand, came through to New Zealand, either from the newsreels on the movies or radio or the newspapers, would be the areas in which the New Zealanders were involved. See, the New Zealanders were involved in the Middle East, and then, of course, later on in the Pacific against the Japanese. And this was the news that came through mostly because it involved local people, and so this was it.
Did you know much about Hitler, though, and the sort of fascism? Were you, you know, I wonder if it had the similar impact in New Zealand as it was having in Britain at that time.
Oh, yes. I would think there's no doubt about it, that people were, you know, appalled at what was going on in Europe. And I think it's fair to say that the dilemma that the pacifist takes is, how do I counteract a thing which is basically evil? Now, I think this is the, and I think we still find this. When I read of the horrors that went on in the concentration camps and listen to some of these documentaries about the Jews, one is appalled. And the immediate reaction is that, well, we must do something positive to eliminate these evil people. But the problem is, by eliminating those with something, war, which you think is evil, do you really ultimately solve the problem? And I think there is a growing awareness in New Zealand at present is that in the good old days, a knight went out and fought a knight and was courageous. But nowadays, the thousands of more civilians who are killed in modern warfare than the people who are involved in it. And this is another dilemma. And we used to argue, I suppose, rightly or wrongly, some would say to you, wouldn't you come in and defend your home if somebody wanted to come in and assault your mother? And the argument would be, does this give me the right to go and blow his mother and children to pieces? And this is the dilemma the conscientious objector is caught in. It's not an easy one. And it goes on and on and on, because war has become so impartial now, and even getting more so, of course, with the new nuclear warfare.
So could I now ask you, which you have sort of gone into a little, your activity at the beginning of the war. Here you were teacher training.
Yes.
And suddenly the government had said that this was not to be.
Yes.
Do I take it that you had registered as a conscientious objector?
Yes. Yes, good.
Could you tell me about the procedure in New Zealand? What was available in 1939
good.
For COs?
Yes. Now, when conscription came in, every young person, and I think over the age of 18...
Could I ask you the date of conscription? When would that have happened before the war, or...?
I think it would happen just when war broke out. Now, I'm not certain on the date, but this book of David Grant will probably give you that. Every young person, I think it was over the age of 18, was sent a form to say that you have been called up for military service. But you have the right to object about this under certain conditions. Now, there are certain kinds of people who were automatically allowed...
exempt.
Exempt,
yes.
Automatically exempt. For instance, I believe all people doing a medical course were exempt. I'm not certain on that. Definitely all the clergy were exempt. And there are certain... of course, essential industries. And I was amused, and I don't know why, but I understand that mountain guides were exempt. And I was very keen on mountaineering at those stages. And so there were a number of people, but the great majority of people were called up for military service. And the great majority of young men, there was no conscription for women, the great majority of young men would then go into army training in the territorials and finally, of course, if necessary, go overseas. I believe that you could elect which armed forces you would enter, either the army, the navy, or the air force. But for those who lodge an appeal, after some time, and I can't remember how long now, you are called up before a conscience objector tribunal, which, if I remember correctly, there were three men sat on it. And they questioned you fairly thoroughly about why you were objecting to military service. One, why weren't you going to the ambulance corps? And if your appeal is not allowed, will you still continue to go into an or non-combatant part of the army? See? And they heard the appeal, and I would think myself they had a very difficult job. It was very easy for people who could object on a strong religious ground. But for those who were humanists, people who were keen about humanity, they tended to deride these people. See, and that's why, I'm not certain on this, but I think that if you belong to one of the traditional peace churches, particularly like the Quakers, your appeal was fairly easy. But of those of us who didn't, and if I remember rightly, the day I was called up, there were 17 appeals were being heard, and I think there were only two allowed out of the 17. See? So that, I didn't envy the chaps, and you could also get people who would speak on your behalf, particularly for church people, to say that you've been involved in young people's work and been a member of the church and done this and the other things. See? So that, and then when if your appeal was granted unconditionally, then, and I think wisely, the government had the right to manpower you into what they would call an essential industry. And because in my first job in the Depression, I had worked in a bacon factory. I was manpowered into a bacon factory in a place called Green Island, just out of Dunedin. And if I understand again correctly, the boss had to pay the normal wage for a tradesman or a working man in those conditions. But the COs only received the same as a private in the army, and the rest was paid into a consolidated fund or something. Now, I think that was, to me, that was quite fair, because there was always the danger that people could say, well, you're staying at home and making lots of money while other people are suffering. And so I thought that was a very fair way to approach the problem. Now, it wasn't very much, as you know, because the army provided so much more than your small salary would allow, but nevertheless, this was part of the thing you had to do. And so that continued on. I worked in the bake. I was in training college in 1940. I went to the bacon factory beginning of 41, and I stayed there till the end of 44 when I joined the Friends Ambulance Unit.
Could I ask you a little bit more about this period? You know, when you went to your tribunal, had you made up your mind what you would do and what you wouldn't do for war?
Yes.
Could you tell me about that?
Glad. Now, I took the attitude, rightly or wrongly, that immediately you tie yourself up with a military machine, you have no... what's the word? Once you tie yourself with a military machine, you must do as you are ordered. You have no escapes. So if they said, okay, you're now under military orders and you'd have to take the military oath that you would obey any commanding officer, you could be then, whether you elected only to go into the ambulance unit or something like this, you could, if they deemed fit, you could be man ordered into the army or the navy or the air force to become part of the combatant service. And I think this was the thing which most COs avoided, not signing up because of this real threat. Basically, that was it. Now, I don't know whether this was the same in Britain or not, but I know that, yeah. Mm.
The ambulance unit you mentioned, this would have been sort of like the RAMC, would it?
Yes. Royal Army Medical. Yes. Doing medical work in the Army, yes. But the Navy or the Air Force, yes. Whatever it might be. Yes.
But the sort of work you were doing came within your sphere of what you would accept, you know, in the bacon factory.
Yeah, because it was all for civilian use. So I was fortunate. And there were people exempt, as I said before, like farmers and people like that, who had to produce food. See? And I recognise also that nobody can isolate themselves from society. See, the most ardent militarist pays his taxes to keep conscience objectors in jail, so that nobody can isolate themselves completely from the community. It doesn't matter what line you take. Yes, good. Sorry.
Did you at this time feel isolated at all, though? You know, you have explained about your parents and how important their support was. But I wondered how you felt yourself, you know, through these war years, as a young man.
I think myself, I felt that I had to stand out on this because of conscience ground, was prepared to take the consequences. And I think it is fair to say that while some people, particularly military people, respected your decision, the ordinary people felt, here's a joker who's either a coward or something, I guess, who's not prepared to face the consequences of war. But I was very interested in that people whom I respect a great deal, they were the people who'd been involved in the army or were still involved in the army, but recognised the position to be courageous enough to stand out against it.
How about your own friends? You know, were several of your friends COs?
No, only this one young man that I can think of was, yes. Because, see, New Zealand is a small country, and it was easier for me because I was living in Dunedin, which was a comparatively biggish place, but for people from the small towns in New Zealand, it must have been extremely difficult. And this will come out again in David Grant's book, if I remember rightly, or in Ormy Burton's book, people who were brought up in small areas. Good.
If you'd bear with me a little longer about this period, your actual tribunal, could you tell me about that, you know, where it was held? And what sort of form it took, you know, what panel sort of interrogated you?
Now, I think it was held, I'm not certain, in the magistrate's court, and I would believe it was made up of three men who were respected citizens of Dunedin. Now, whether they were... And I would think, by and large, they were probably people who weren't particularly fond of conscience objectors. They may have been ex-servicemen, but people, I would say, whose opinion, whose judgment was respected.
Can you remember their attitude towards you, the sort of atmosphere when you went in to make your statement?
No, I can't. I'm sorry, except that...
Did you feel, you know, very uncomfortable, or was it just sort of...
Well, I think they tried their hardest to break down your arguments. As I said before, that they'd say, well, what would you do if someone came in to murder your mother or something like this? Now, those were the common kind of arguments that most people were subject to, and they pressed this one fairly hard on finer points of your attitude. But for myself, I kept coming through, I hope, to say to myself, consciously or unconsciously, fair enough, but what would Christ have done in this situation? And so, and then, of course, they would also bring up the argument, well, okay, Christ went into the temple and drove the thieves out, or something like the merchandise. So that they used all the biblical and socialist arguments they could. And you just had to resolve and say, I'm sorry that under no circumstances will I join up with the armed forces. And finally, you broke through. We hope. Good.